Welcome, everyone, to Food Conversation Season 5. Once again, we acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral land of the Shukwukamek people, and that this land has been essentially stolen from them by settler intrusion, and that's an issue that we all have to work on resolving together. Today we have two guests who we've wanted to have on the show for a long time because they're bringing to us a whole world that is important for us to share, and that is the world of Indigenous culture, and particularly Indigenous culture as it relates to food, but Indigenous culture in general. Those two guests are Lana Purcell and Sherelle Anderson, respectively the Executive Director and the Program Director for Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. Welcome, Lana and Sherelle.
Thank you for having us, Warren.
Thank you.
Delighted to have you here. Delighted because it's coming clearer to most of us that we have to learn from one another and we have to start hearing voices that we have not paid enough attention to in the past. And I'm hoping that you too will be able to give us a good lesson in some of the values that we need to pick up from the Indigenous world. Now, let's start off with just saying what Rise Up Indigenous Wellness is all about. Lana, as the senior member of the team, what would you say the fundamental purpose of your organization is?
So Rise Up Indigenous Wellness is a society that focuses on connecting families to wellness through an Indigenous perspective. So we have programs that are for children, youth, workshops and retreats, and yeah, so our main focus is really holistic wellness, often leaning towards the teachings of the medicine wheel.
Very much sounds to me like what I know about Indigenous culture, this notion of holism, of bringing all aspects of one's experience together.
Absolutely, and it's kind of our focus has grown as we've worked together and worked in the urban Indigenous community. We've noticed gaps or needs or had requests for different sort of programming, and we've adapted to meet that.
Sherelle, do you have anything to add from your point of view, that now that you're a trained social worker, do you have anything that you would like to add to that kind of perspective?
Well, I think we need to also get back to that land is medicine and culture heals. And it's nice to have that connection and be able to create a community, because there's lots of Indigenous people who live here, but they may not be connected and they may be feeling a sense of loss or disconnection from their home community.
Yes. We, the Wet'suwet'en people, have a healing lodge on their land right next to this massive pipeline that Coastal GasLink is pushing through their territory. And it's based on land-centered healing. And it's remarkable how effective that can be. Now, you have a wide range of programs, and we'll go through, work our way through them. But perhaps you mentioned about working in urban settings, Lana. Is that sort of where a start took place, or is that just part of what you do?
So when we say urban Indigenous, it really refers to people of Indigenous ancestry who are living away from their home communities. So in Canada, that's the majority of Indigenous people are off reserve, living outside of their home communities for a big range of reasons. So oftentimes they're not receiving supports and services from their band because they're not there in their home communities, and also feeling disconnected. So that's really been a focus for us. We do have contacts and reach out to the local bands and do some work as well, but our main focus is urban Indigenous.
Now, that's interesting because both of you are living in an area that's not part of your original land. Sherelle, why don't you give all your relations?
So my grandmother was from Saddle Lake Cree Nation. Good Fish Reserve, to be specific. And her and my grandfather moved to Clearwater because he got a job at the mill. And then my mother was raised in Clearwater as well, and so was I. So I we're two generations removed from our home community.
What's that like being far away from your immediate roots?
Well, I just think also being Indigenous, there's a lot about family, and that's like deeply rooted within us. And we would visit Alberta as a child quite a bit, and lots of times we would have family come and just on their way through, and our doors were always open. Like, so
isn't this the case that when you're Indigenous, there's a sense of sharing with anyone else who's Indigenous?
Yeah, doors always open.
We should all be so civilized. Lana, how about your roots, which are also at a bit of a distance?
So I, too, am away from my home community. I'm a Haksha band member, Stadtlium Nation, which is sort of close to Mount Currie or Pemberton out that way. But I grew up in Mica Creek and Revelstoke and at that area because my stepfather was working on the dams there. So usually our traditional way to introduce ourselves would be I'm the great-granddaughter of Agnes Nelson, granddaughter of Alice Purcell. And yeah, so I mean, I get out to my band meetings and go to events in my community, but it's not the same as living there either.
So when you move away, you move away physically, but you don't move away emotionally. For both of you, that's home. That's where your people are.
Absolutely. I think last summer we did a trek on my home territory with young people called Returning to the Homelands. And a lot of it was for off-reserve young people from my band to be able to get back on the land and just feel that ancestral connection.
It's such a different experience for so many people who have come from across the Atlantic Ocean. Their sense of displacement is huge, and their sense of connection back to their home is often, you know, that's a big ocean between you and sometimes the rest of this continent between you and your family of origin. It's clear that for both of you, this is not how it is. It's still back there and here. It's sort of in your life here and your life there that you have your families.
Oh yeah, like I know when I return, it's always open arms, and they know who I am. They know who my family is because they've always been there.
Does that, for both of you, is that a really important sustaining force in your lives, this feeling that you still have this very alive, very vibrant connection with your families?
Absolutely. I think that connection to the actual land that our ancestors derive from and that we're connected to creates that long-term sense of culture and mm-hmm. belonging.
And I want listeners to know, because I think this is very important, that each of your mothers is on the board of directors of your organization, which is something that is so misunderstood in the settler culture. You know, there's all these checks and balances so you don't have sort of conflicts of interest. But for both of you, your mothers supply incredible support in multiple dimensions.
Oh, yeah, I agree. And it's also getting back to Indigenous culture. Like, we're family. Why wouldn't we work together and work alongside each other? There's so much knowledge to be shared from both of our moms. They have so much to give.
And both of them being Indigenous off-reserve elders have a big understanding for the people that we work with, what it is that, you know, our fellow participants might need.
Sure. Now, Sherelle, you have been working for the school board in a series of capacities. Why don't you just run through that sequence of events that started out with...
So when I got hired on, I was Indigenous Education Support Worker. Yeah. And
what was your job then? What were you doing?
So I was supporting children in the classroom and working alongside teachers to help, I guess, implement culture into their classroom as well. And then as I was working as an Indigenous Education Support Worker, I was also completing my Bachelor of Social Work So once I was finished that, I became an Indigenous outreach worker for the school district. And then I was able to offer more programming and one-on-one support. And that gave me the opportunity to take kids more outside into nature. And I wouldn't say I was a counselor, but I was able to work with them one-on-one in a natural setting. It wasn't talk therapy. It was like, okay, let's just be natural where we are.
I'm just thinking that's sort of the ideal job. You're working and rambling around outdoors.
Yeah, no complaints.
Everybody should be so lucky. Mm. Lana, your trajectory is a little bit different, a little bit longer, a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit older than Cheryl.
you don't have to say that, no. But you did, so it's good.
No, I took a Bachelor of General Studies, and I had been focused on primary education when I was offered a position with the school district here in Salmon Arm. And working in the Indigenous Ed program. And I was with the program for 25 years. So I saw a lot of changes and things that varied throughout. So, yeah, so with the program until just last year.
So change. There's a lot of change going on in the world right now. What changes have you observed in the years you've been working, over a quarter century, as... Yes, it's that long, isn't it?
Big eyes.
You couldn't see folks on the radio, but there was an expression that told me I touched a sensitive point. What kind of changes have you seen?
I think the viewpoint of non-Indigenous educators has grown and changed over the years from being not extremely... well-versed in our history and in our culture to a sense of wanting to embrace things and work towards reconciliation. Mm. So that was frontline observed, like to when I started, where there was resistance against Indigenous education programs to like more of a growth mindset.
Do you know what move that change along? I'm sure it was the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in its report, which was very extensive, very complete, and very revealing for a lot of non-Indigenous people who just didn't realize what had happened. The reporting of Indigenous treatment in various settings was not even included in history, social studies, you know, geography. None of that was included. Cheryl, have you, even though you've had not as long a period, but have you seen changes too? In your work in the school system?
Oh, yeah. Like, I think parents and teachers are more open, too, to understanding our history. And I think it's because of the education out there now. Like, our history is, to say, maybe being rewritten. Like, the truth mm-hmm. is coming out now.
Yeah, it's being written.
Yeah, written.
As opposed
yeah.
to not having been written at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Either of you speak with non-Indigenous people, sort of do presentations to give them background on what's going on?
Oh yeah, we two of our more popular workshops with that we offer is Indigenous wellness workshop. So we do a wellness workshop, and it's based around the medicine. We also we focus on the physical, the mental, and the emotional and spiritual health. And then we also have a workshop called Deconstructing Stereotypes, and we dive into stereotypes that are out there about Indigenous people, and we create a safe place because we want it out there, and we want to be able to have an open discussion about it.
And do the people who come, are they ready to hear what you have to say?
I think so. And it's organizations that hire us, so they want their employees to have this background
shape
knowledge
up.
Yeah.
Just want to remind listeners that our guests today on the show are Lana Purcell and Cheryl Anderson, who are respectively the executive director and the program director for Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. Lana, is the way Cheryl is describing it, does that fit with what you've seen, but over this longer perspective?
Yeah, I think, we've definitely seen change within the school system, but some of that, I think, too, is that educators are being educated more. Like, at the time when I started, I don't think a lot of the elementary school teachers were really getting that background prior to going into teaching positions. And then in terms of the public, I mean, there's still misinformation. And with our Deconstructing Stereotypes and Myths workshop, it's amazing how often the same misinformation comes up. And because it's a safe place to discuss it, people feel comfortable and learn, oh, that's not actually a fact. It's something that we thought was a fact that isn't.
Yeah, something like, well, everything's paid for Indigenous people. Do you get that particular line?
There's that one, like free housing, no taxes. There's a sort of slew of regular ones that people are misinformed on. And when you do a Google search, some of those questions pop up right away, so you know how often people are looking them up.
Sure. Would either of you like to just give a small version of why that some of these contentions about the free ride idea are wrong? Sherelle?
Well, it's just, I think it makes Indigenous people look like we put ourselves here, that it wasn't designed, like it was actually designed that the Canadian government wanted to assimilate us. And now there's all these repercussions of intergenerational trauma, and we have to work at undoing that.
Mm-hmm. Do people say to you, why can't Indigenous people just get over it? Do you hear those kinds of lines?
Unfortunately, yes. I feel like Sherelle's brother put it very well when the recoveries of the children began coming out more. Sure. At the residential schools. He said,
how can we say goodbye to the past if we haven't said hello?
So being able to acknowledge what's actually happened, we can't let go of something that we haven't even been able to unpack.
Did you find when these graves were being detected and talked about, that changed the mindset of a fair number of people? I've heard people say, oh my goodness, it didn't sink in until then.
I think in non-Indigenous people, I think it opened their eyes. I think Indigenous people knew. The kids knew there, the families knew.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Of course.
And it was re-traumatizing for so many of our people.
I'm sure. I remember Tecumloch's chief saying, please just leave us alone for a while. We have to absorb this and assimilate it and work it through ourselves, which I thought was very wise. I mean, that's obviously very much part of what happens in Indigenous communities. You work it through within the community.
And I think each of us from different communities, as more and more ground penetrating radars used on, like I know where my grandmother went to residential school to St. Mary's and Mission is now being processed, I guess is how they word it.
And I think it's important, like Lana said, recovery, and that's what it is. It wasn't a discovery. Like,
yes, you're sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. How's that for you working in sharing Indigenous culture, both with Indigenous youth and also with non-Indigenous citizens? What's that like for you to have this swirling process of new developments, new discoveries, new
recoveries?
What's it like personally?
Well, I think it's stuff we've always known, right? Now people are starting to realize it. So we're always kind of trying to get our thoughts in place so that we can articulate what's happening.
But traumatizing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
I mean,
I was going to say. That's
we,
what I
meant. I'm just thinking of with Kamloops, like that was very, like everyone we knew, we're going through a rough re-traumatization from working through that. And our elders, you know, remembering their times at the schools or remembering their connections and just, yeah, all those pieces.
And it wasn't one family or two families.
It was
a
community.
Population,
yes,
of people.
Absolutely.
But we're resilient people.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, if you think that it's like 10% of Indigenous people survived all of the things in the past, those of us who are here because our ancestors are resilient.
And is that a shift also that's taking place from endless statistics about how difficult life is in Indigenous communities and disease rates and all this kind of stuff to the resilience story? That you're hearing that more?
I think so. I mean, I think that our communities are looking internally for our power and strength mm-hmm. and what we carry forward with us.
Yeah, I, as a non-Indigenous person, I get tired of hearing people say, no, the statistics show things are, you know, worse on a reserve. Well, they're not worse. They're worse in some respects, but in some ways they're better. And that's what we're talking about today, how some Indigenous cultural ideas are really a lot better than some of the things we've been doing for a long time and thinking we're pretty normal. Maybe we're right.
Well, and part of that's too, like shifting worldviews, like what you value and what someone else values can be vastly different.
I think we're in a world now where sharing values, no matter who you are and where you are and what your values are, has become a bit of a watchword. You know, that's what we have to do. If you were born in this century, get on with it. Start learning, exploring, finding out what other people are doing. I think it's a very valuable thing to be talking about this, to set a context, because your organization obviously is actively working to bring cultural values from the Indigenous community back into the cultural minds, if you like, of Indigenous folks, but also sharing it more broadly so that others can see and understand why we've been leaving something out if we're non-Indigenous. We've just the fact that you comfortably have your mothers on the board of directors. I really am tickled by that. I mean, it really seems like, you know, how many families in the non-Indigenous community have maintained that kind of warm connection with the older generation and the respect and the affection that goes along with it. Anyway, that's a little plug for what you're doing.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about what you do, because you do a range of different things. It's not just one or two things. You do quite a bunch of stuff. So, of course, this is food conversation, so part of it will be about food. But why don't you run through the range of programs you offer? We've talked about stuff with youth, but why don't you can go back and forth and
sure. Okay.
This is ping pong.
So Rise Up Indigenous Wellness has a really broad range of programming. We started off focusing on the land camps with young people, and we really grew from there. From on the land camps, we started doing workshops, women's retreats, presenting anxiety reduction programs for Indigenous people, the workshops that we mentioned earlier.
And then we, through our programs, we offer food security as well. It takes a bit of the stigma away too. Like, so when the children come to our camps, we give them food to take home. So we're not a food bank. So it's a nice way to distribute food that way
gift.
Too.
It's a gift, a wonderful gift.
Yeah. So all of our programs, we have a food component, and it's really in keeping with that Indigenous model of holistic wellness. So, yeah, like Cheryl said, sometimes it's sent home at the end of a camp. With some of our other gatherings, we focus on making some of the food while we're gathering over different topics. And sometimes it's cooking with kids, too.
Doesn't food add a special dimension to a gathering?
Oh, it does. And it's just so cultural, too, in the sharing and the being together. And even when you're preparing it, you're using your hands and you're doing something for the good of the community or the good of the group.
Like, it's like the gathering over food will bring us together.
Yeah, it seems to, actually, I think it's a universal phenomenon. You go to some place far away from your home and you walk in the door and somebody says, can I give you something to eat or something to drink or something like that? It's a very smart thing. Works for just about everybody. Let's talk about some specific programs, okay? The Cook With Our Kids program. Who wants to talk about that?
So Cook With Our Kids program was started off with us wanting to bring children and families together. So we were trying to find a good way to address different parenting topics. And what better way than sitting down and making food together? And we knew that there was people wanting information and ideas around how to access healthy food more inexpensively, how to make some simple meals for their families. And it was a very popular and is a very popular program. We're not able to run that program all the time. Just when we run from grant to grant. So when we get funded, we're able to.
So some of the food is indigenous food. Is there sometimes non-indigenous food included?
So it's a combination. We really focus on decolonizing the diet. So we look a lot at trying to find local sources of food, incorporating foods that would have been traditional to what our people would have eaten. And so when we can, we do that. But we also use what's available as well, but avoiding foods with preservatives and highly processed foods.
Sherelle?
Yes. And that's our focus, is just keeping it fresh.
Yeah, fresh, natural food.
Fresh, natural
food. Like, for
food.
Example, would you make a distinction between beef from a cow and venison from a deer?
We would prefer the game when we can. And often, like, we'll have game and fish and, you know, roots and berries and try to focus on those foods.
There's quite a lot of stuff around here. I've talked to Bonnie Thomas about some of the things they've been growing here, and there's an amazing amount of food actually growing. Plant medicine workshops.
So this is during our women's retreat, we have a plant medicine worker, lady Laura Dola, and she's able to take our women out on the land and show them the different plants that are available and what they're used for, like the proper way to harvest, and just be on the land and see the abundance of herbs and medicines that are out there.
And really, like, addressing land and food as medicine.
I was working in emergency 15 or so years ago, and a young man who was non-Indigenous came to the emergency room to get some, believe it or not, Valium for an Indigenous young man who was feeling very badly. And he said, "I'm learning from the Indigenous elders." And so I said, "Well, why don't you go to them for some help for this young man?" And he actually did. He thought it over and went away. But one thing he said was, one of the elders said to him, took him to a field and said, "There's my pharmacy." Is that the sort of thing that resonates with your program and the teacher you have who does it with you?
Oh yeah, I think so, for sure. There's everything you need out there. And think about how good being outside just in general is for your mental health.
But the sort of sad fact is how disconnected our communities have become from those traditional teachings and knowledge. And like Sherelle alluded to earlier, like that was on purpose early on, like disconnecting Indigenous people and putting the communities far away from anything. And so it fosters a sense of dependency in many ways.
True. One of the very first programs of the Canadian government back in the 1870s and 80s was literally taking Indigenous people away from their lands where they hunted and gathered and putting them on farms. I mean, literally trying to get them to become farmers, which, of course, didn't work very well because nobody wanted to do it. But it was just this incredible indifference to the values and the experience of the people who had been were expert foragers. They could tell when something was ripe and when you could harvest it, that kind of thing.
Well, and that traditional knowledge was seen as primitive, like it's sort of primitive rather than something of value. And you think, like, some of what we've heard, like the Canada's very first prime minister, John A. Macdonald, said, starve out the Indians.
Yes.
Like, it was like food as warfare.
Yeah, it was exactly that. The movie The Fallen Feather, which includes Bonnie Thomas and her story in Kamloops Residential School, makes specific reference to the fact that the purpose was to get the land. And if you get the land, you disconnect the people who are attached to the land from that connection. And then you can have free...
Yeah, like the government wanted indigenous people to become dependent on them because they knew that they could be completely independent of the government. So that was their way of assimilation.
Sorry, the weight of all this sort of is all around us still. And yet you're obviously doing a really excellent job of trying to bridge the gap so that people get to hear the actual story of what went on.
Well, in the revival of our traditional knowledge, helps to move us towards food sovereignty. The
Indeed.
More that we begin to understand what is around us and what serves us, the more,
And that's, in fact, the theme of food conversations in general. We're aiming at enhancing food sovereignty because it's one step beyond food security. Food security means you have enough to eat and you don't starve, but food sovereignty means you have control over the food supply, and that's precisely what we're talking about. Just want to remind listeners that our guests today on the show are Lana Purcell and Sherelle Anderson, who are respectively the executive director and the program director for Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. So let's talk about emergency food hampers.
So I think emergency food hampers has kind of morphed into Helping Hands, mm-hmm. which is a program that we're doing once a month now, that we're able to prepare about 15 packs of food, keeping it fresh food, and we're distributing it to families. It's not the same families. It's almost on a as-needed basis.
Is that program easy to fund? I mean, grants are your major source of funding. Is that, or is it kind of come and go? And
one of the things that's frustrating for us is really that we don't have sustainable funding, so we're always having to seek out grants. And during COVID, it was quite a bit easier to get some food security type of funds because
People
were thinking about it, and there was a lot of emergency funds available. But when sort of some of that stage of the pandemic ended, that type of funding ended too, the more emergency-based funding. But yet the price of groceries shot up, and the price of transportation and travel to get things shot up. So unfortunately, the need is still there, but the funding is very difficult to access.
It's funny how the best laid plans, you're ready to go, and then something comes along. That's the problem with grant funding. It's very precarious, and one minute you've got money to do something, and the next minute it's just vanished into thin air. So let's talk about keeping something going in a different way, the food preservation workshops. Now, that's something that's very much part of Indigenous culture, as I understand it, how to keep the food when you don't have a big refrigerator necessarily. Sherelle, food preservation 101.
Well, it's canning. It's a lost art. And we need to take the food that's in season and preserve it. So Lana and I were talking, like, with the springtime right now, asparagus is going to become readily available. So we're going to preserve asparagus in May, hopefully. So that'll be our first step. And then come the end of summer, we'll preserve more. And then we're able to give out our canned food in our, like, Helping Hands packs.
And we have other people help with the preservation. So it's, like, instructional. And it's that whole model of helpers needing help themselves too. So it's not like a handout. It's like, oh, we're all together making this food. It's going home with families who need it.
Part of what has gone on in the Salmon River area is salmon, of course. Salmon is very abundant, was very abundant until they were building a railroad in the Fraser Canyon. They dumped a bunch of rock in the river and they cut off the early fall run of sockeye that comes up in the Salmon River. That was a bad move. But canning is one form, but a long, widely used form was drying and smoking. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can talk about that a little bit, because I think That's a very interesting way of keeping the food healthy.
Yeah. So we also do. We have two smokers and do some salmon smoking and game, like dry meat kind of thing, and a dehydrator for dehydrating things. We had wanted to add like a more modern thing, like a freeze dryer, just in terms of like making more foods last and be accessible.
Yeah. How did that go? Did you get one?
We haven't got one yet. They're very expensive. But
how much do they cost?
Like
$4,000.
Oh, yeah.
Right. It's a little out. We're already hustling for money just to get food.
I think we have to get sun-dried next.
Yeah.
That's going to be happening for a while. Mm-hmm. And also, it's very much a seasonal thing, right? You do different things at different times of the mm-hmm. year. How many workshops of that sort would you have in a year? One in the spring, one in the fall? Is that sort of... Or
maybe two in the fall.
And what kind of, while we're on the subject of workshops in general, how many people tend to turn up? I mean, obviously it's different for the, depending on the subject matter, but what's the typical size of a workshop group that you gather together?
Well, right now we're just doing it to prepare it for our like packs that we give out. So it's usually four or five of us are together.
Mm-hmm. And then the food preservation would be a little bit larger group. We can't work with too large of a group with some of them. So say the cook with kids, we used to have about 10 mm-hmm. Parents and then kids as well on top of that.
So the parents and kids would be coming to the same workshop.
Yeah, but we'd get a babysitter for the kids. We'd hire a babysitter.
Very young kids.
Yeah, the little ones.
Yeah, for the kids and they'd go do crafts.
Like teenagers or kids in their... 10, 12, 14.
It was usually small kids that would come with the parents. Okay. And I think it was also that connection with the moms, with having kids that little too. It was nice just to have mom time.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be another universal phenomenon, isn't it? So let's talk about some of the workshops that are not directly connected to food, but obviously would have some connection to food indirectly. Indigenous wellness workshops.
So Indigenous Wellness Workshops, it was one of our earliest workshops that we started presenting out in the community because we thought we all as humans, we respect what we understand. And we felt like having a lack of understanding of our cultural beliefs makes it hard to respect the reasons why we do things. So the Indigenous Wellness is really something that's very gentle and supports people in understanding our worldview and our ways of doing things.
So it's not just for Indigenous people.
In fact, it's been with non-Indigenous community members and just looking at what are things that you can do to care for your wellness in an Indigenous-based model.
And what kind of reactions did you get from people when they see how developed the thinking was within Indigenous communities? It wasn't just, you know, that simple-minded notion of being primitive, it's actually quite sophisticated. Does that impress people?
Well, I think they see the connection because it's like a holistic approach. So if we're looking at it as a medicine wheel, they see how everything overlaps between your physical self and your mental self, your spiritual self and emotional self. If one of those is off balance, then your whole being is off balance. And just by laying it out like in a workshop with visuals and having them a part of it, like sharing their what they do for wellness, they can see, oh, okay, maybe I do need to work a little bit on my mental self, and it all relates to each other.
So let me ask you a question about the non-Indigenous community. What's your thoughts on the one problem, 10-minute office visit at a doctor's?
Well, it's not a holistic view, and it's, you can't... It's not taking in the whole picture and putting into perspective lived experiences or what's happening with them on their mentally and emotionally too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think like we've grown out in these different directions with our nonprofit because of the holistic model where like, oh, we can't just like look at just working with children without looking at the family. We can't work with families without realizing that we need to find avenues for supporting food and making sure everybody's finding some access to healthy food. And so it all connects really through that holistic model.
Did you at the beginning, has Rise Up Indigenous Wellness, has it sort of morphed as you've gone along? Have you added in programs and workshops, or was it all, do you start off with all that?
Oh no, it's snowballed.
Snowballed, even in summer.
Yeah, exactly. Because it started off with us focusing with on the land camps. And then, like Lana said, then we had to look at the families. And then that kind of went into women's workshops that we've been able to facilitate. Mm-hmm. And then non-Indigenous organizations started asking us about workshops. So.
Specifically about women's workshops, what happens there?
So it's just a time where we can bring women together and be on the land. At our last one, we made ribbon skirts, and we're just kind of around the kitchen table. We share food, share stories, and we do something together.
Mm-hmm. And it sort of leans into that multi-generational younger women with elders and in between, and our power as healers and life givers, as women, that how when we come together, even though we're laughing and having a great time, we're still like looking at other ways to help our community.
It's good medicine.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys ever drum?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah. The part of our last women's, well, the last few, we'd mm-hmm. had drum circles with the retreat too.
What's that like in terms of sort of bringing the group together and, I mean, it's like food. You do it collectively. You have to be in rhythm with the other people in the group, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think we're like intrinsically connected to the drum. It's the heartbeat, right?
Yeah,
it's the
sure.
first sound we hear is our mother's heartbeat. That's reminiscent of the drum. The heartbeat of the earth is all around us.
You know, it's funny how for generations, Western science said that when you're in the womb, you can't hear and you can't feel, and you don't know what's going on, and so you have no idea. I mean, nobody says that now, but I can remember the idea was that your central nervous system wasn't developed, you hadn't formed a covering over the nerves, and so they couldn't keep memories, and all this kind of stuff, which has just gone right out the window.
It's interesting, like, how our traditional knowledge ties into, like, as medicine's changing and growing. Like, I think a lot of our teachings, like, well, there's one food teaching around you shouldn't gather and consume food if you're feeling very angry and upset. And now you think about mindful eating and that ability to absorb nutrients better when you're in a calm state. And we had many food teachings in our Indigenous communities. And some of that was lost too around, you know, the lost art of oral storytelling and, again, disconnection.
Do you guys ever have a connection with cooking in the ground? I know that was very much, I've talked to some of the elders in the Shkwepmek community here, and they have talked about it quite eloquently and how yummy it was and how effective and how the mm-hmm. you know, food really cooked well.
Yeah, so in my territory, like I'm Statliam, and then here in Shkwepmek territory, where I've been a visitor for many years, I've encountered and have eaten pit cooked food for many years and like a number of times. And part of it was the person pit cooking, knowing how to layer which grasses and which herbs would add flavor. But we actually had if the person is not experienced and hasn't heated the pit enough, we had a gathering at our band where everybody was sort of waiting all day for the food to come later on. And the first thing they scooped out was one of the potatoes. And when it dropped onto the plate, it was like, thunk, like hard. And so we're like, oh, back in the pit. Looks like we're eating something else this evening.
Just want to remind listeners that our guests today on the show are Lana Purcell and Sherelle Anderson, who are respectively the executive director and the program director for Rise Up Indigenous Wellness. That raises the whole issue, and you've touched on it before, about how the efforts made by the non-Indigenous community to sort of stamp out Indigenous culture has left many Indigenous people of all generations cut off and distanced and really sometimes unable to access their own culture. Do you find yourselves working on that very issue that you have Indigenous young people, older people coming in and they just don't know what you're talking about? And they say, well, my God, look at this world that's opening up for us.
So, like, what comes to mind for me with that question is our traditional stories were the way of passing on knowledge and passing on information. And our stories always linked us back to the earth and ways to respect where our food came from, whether it was the earth people, plant people, animal people. And so not being connected with those stories makes it more difficult for some of our young people to understand those traditional teachings. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I mentioned to Sherelle earlier, my grandmother used to pass on different ideas around foods that were just our traditions, like about not eating food if you were around someone who was sort of bad energy, that you wouldn't consume that, or that when we gather together and eat, if you're teaching, what the knowledge becomes part of you as the food goes in, the knowledge comes in. So that was why the food was so intrinsically part of our culture.
And is this leading, Sherelle, to talking and maybe just living out the spiritual values of that they're underpinning all cultures, but Indigenous culture in particular?
Oh, I think so. By sharing food, and you're creating a community, which builds up your spirit too, and it's all connected to each other.
Do you talk about the sort of intrinsic value of things, that plants have a value that is inherent in them, and that animals also have an energy, a spirit that is in them and that is worthy and that deserves respect, that kind of thing?
Oh, for sure. And there's an old saying too that, like, humans are the most pathetic because we need to rely on the plants and the earth and the animals for survival, whereas they don't need us. So we need to pay them that respect.
Yes, indeed.
And I think, like, instilling that idea that our food is a gift, it's a gift that's coming from the earth and from around us, so that gift of that food needs to be honored by not wasting and not overusing or over harvesting.
Do you include then ceremony sometimes or protocols in the work you do with people?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some, depending where people are from, like, often one of our food protocols is leaving a plate of food for the ancestors, for those who came before us. Another protocol is making sure to just take what you need, like be aware of what you're taking and what you've taken, use it all, make sure to use it all and give thanks. Like, a lot of times if you're harvesting food, you're having ceremony and prayer prior to even the harvesting process.
It's done in the right spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that sometimes in the non-Indigenous community, some of these values that you're talking about just don't seem to be very well developed, that there's a kind of utilitarian, mechanistic way of approaching food? Sherelle, your chance.
Well, I also think maybe going back to your previous question about leaving something, it's like leaving tobacco. It, like, that's an offering when you harvest. So in a non-Indigenous world, people are like, tobacco, like, that's, like, why would you do that? But it's one of our sacred medicines, like, before it became commercialized, and it's what you would smoke to send your thoughts up to the Creator.
There's reports of early non-Indigenous people coming out to some of the Hudson's Bay posts and then being invited to an Indigenous ceremony, and the pipe would be passed around and they would take a puff and it would be pretty powerful stuff, no additives, not cut with anything, and they would feel that they'd really gone through quite a big experience when they did that puff. It was really a profound change in consciousness, and that's what was valued at those ceremonies. It wasn't, you know, something you can do for pleasure. It was something you did to honor and respect the process that you were engaged in, a peace treaty or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. And remembering the source of our food is something we really try to instill too, because so often if our young people haven't been taught that it doesn't just come from the grocery store. That
in a package,
processed and not looking like anything, that our food, where it came from, brings us back to our connection to the land and our gratitude for those things.
Gratitude, a very important sentiment. Where do you see things going as you expand your work? We've already used the term snowballing, getting bigger, getting broader. Where do you see things going as the future unfolds? It's impossible to know exactly what it will be like, but Lana, what do you have in your mind?
So our ideal goals in terms of being able to support families in moving forward would be like more support to have more food to be able to put out in the community, more programming that includes people within the programming, so we're not doing for, we're doing with.
Sure.
And growing from there. We're not a food bank where we're at, but we'd love when our programs incorporate families into that self-care and knowledge of food.
Some
good food,
smoked salmon.
Yum.
Shrill, what are your thoughts about that?
I think, it's about sustainability, being able to consistently offer programming and networking, being able to, we only know what we know, so it would be nice to offer it out to more people, to bring more community in to help with our programming and like our food preservations, because there's lots we don't know either.
And reinvigorating that connection to the food and land. You think about like when you're known as the salmon people, and then your salmon access at one point in history was interrupted, and then dams, and then pollution of their environment, all those things. Like, who are you then? Who am I if what my identity is interrupted so hugely?
The science of ecology, which is a relatively new term. The term wasn't even used 50 years ago, but the science of ecology is saying exactly what you're saying. It's almost like two people climbing up a mountain and then meeting at the top and saying, what are you doing here? And you say, what you're doing? Oh, well, that's sort of what we're doing with a different perspective. It's wonderful sometimes to see Indigenous people working in field projects and science projects and saying, well, let's look at it this way. Let's look at it in a more holistic, a broader, multidimensional way rather than just, you know, get the project done, move on to the other. So talking about sustainability, one part of sustainability is having enough money to do the programming. We talked about that a little bit. How has that been over time in terms of getting grants? The station runs on, much of it runs on grants, so we're very familiar with this fragile state you can get into. What's it been like?
Well, we're constantly looking for grants. We're always applying. We have a grant tracker to see when grants are happening to make sure that we don't miss any, and we apply for anything that we think is relevant to Rise Up that will work.
And when you make a proposal to an organization that you've scouted out, you think they're probably in the same wavelength as you are, what's the response been in a general sense?
Oh, it's been positive. We've been successful in obtaining a number of grants. It's constant, and it's Lana and I are the ones who are writing it and
researching it. You need to find out what type of projects have they funded in the past, who do they like to fund. So yeah, there's all that piece. So I guess our other thing in looking forward to the future is increasing our capacities and being able to have more regular staff. Right now we just have part-time people who work with us, and ideally we'd have, you know, grow our programming and have some more program outreach staff.
What kind of part-time staff do you have now helping you out with the work you're doing?
Helping us facilitate workshops.
So they come to the workshops and help. Do they do the management part and you do the teaching, or is it just a little bit of everybody doing something?
I'd say a little, like Lon and I kind of do the managing and they do the facilitating, but we also do the facilitating as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you could look into the future, and we're coming to the close of our program, if you were looking into the future, what would be your ideal outcome after another 10, 15, 20 years of doing this work?
Like full sustainable when we look at food, full sustainable food system. So people in the community, helping people in the community, more traditional ways of hunting and fishing and harvesting naturally and processing together even.
Yeah, just the sharing of the food and the knowledge and the wisdom, the culture.
One thing that Bonnie Thomas and Chief Judy Wilson said, they did a little presentation to one of the local community groups here, and they said that the real focus all the time in Indigenous communities was community. If food arrived, it was shared. If tasks were at hand, it was shared. Does that sound like a good summation of the fundamental spirit in a Indigenous perspective?
I think so.
Yeah, we never would, hoarding was sort of seen as an illness. And oftentimes our games and activities were to redistribute the wealth. Like if you lost
the
something.
The potlatch.
Yeah, yeah. Or like even gambling games, traditional ones. It wasn't that the gambling was bad. It was another way to redistribute what you had so that it was more evenly dispersed.
Like it's not an I mentality. It's sure. A we mentality.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you've really brought a wonderful way of looking at the world to us to share with others. And we are very glad and happy and delighted and grateful that you've come and joined us today. Thank you, Anna and Cheryl. This has been a wonderful time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks for having us, Warren.